Cause yellow again, everybody. Scott Bowden and Brian Lass right along ringside and ready to go with another big day of Kentucky Fried Wrestling. And Brian, I am ready to freak out, do the thing, because we have an ICW invasion on our hands today.
Yowza, yowza, yowza.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
Okay, then. Well, that's right, Scott. Today we welcome the legendary leader of the ICW United States Tag Team Champions, the Devil's Duo. He is the nefarious braided pawnbroker from Brooklyn, the mastermind behind the Slapowitz Syndicate, Izzy Slapowitz.
Yowza! We'll be right back with this outlaw edition of the KFR podcast.
What do you mean outlaw? What do you mean outlaw? Independent is the preferred nomenclature.
What? Independent, please. Come on. How many ICW guys do you know of? These ICW outlaws, how many of them did you ever see do a bunch of silly flips in the ring for no apparent reason?
Have you ever heard of Leaping Lenny?
Oh, okay. Okay, fine. But who was he in the whole scheme of things?
Leaping Lenny Poffo was former ICW world champion, son of the co-owner Angelo Poffo, and brother of the longtime ICW world champion Randy Savage. That's who he was in the whole scheme of things.
Kayfabe, you goof.
Okay, yes. I also believe Lanny was indeed himself an ICW co-founder as well.
Freak out! Do the thing!
All right, dude, enough.
We'll be right back on the KFR podcast with ICW invader Izzy Slapowitz right after this important macho message.
Macho Man and the Cowboy, going to Manchester, Kentucky, man, special stipulation, tag team elimination, first gotta lose the first ball, we get rid of him. And let it be Bob Roop, so it'll be 2-on-1 in the ring in a tornado accident against Ronnie Garvin. Let it be Ronnie Garvin, baby.
Oh, man, I hope it's Bob Roop. Whichever way it goes, we're going to rip him apart. But there's one point I want to make. Kentucky people are good, strong, courageous people. The Kentucky Wildcats had the guts to go all the way to Oklahoma and play the Oklahoma Sooners. But it seems like you Kentucky people back wrestlers who won't accept challenges. Jarrett, Welch, Tommy, what's his name, Larry something?
Well, it's an obvious Gojo Yamamoto, they're fake.
You people are tough people. If I wanted to fight a Kentuckian, I can go out on the corner and fight any one of you. What's the matter with them guys?
And we are back on Kentucky Fried Wrestling. Growing up as a young fan in Memphis in the 1970s, my only television exposure to the wild and woolly world of professional wrestling was Jerry Jarrett's aptly titled Championship Wrestling Program, which aired Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. on Channel 5 WMC-TV, the local NBC affiliate. That all changed in fall 1979 when another wrestling promotion, led by its outrageous world heavyweight champion Randy Macho Man Savage, started appearing at 10 a.m. on Channel 24 WPTY. Now, this was the market's first UHF outlet and independent station. And I vividly recall coming home from school and, you know, we only had three channels back then and turning that dial past Leave It to Beaver and whatever else was on. And suddenly there was a fourth channel. And not only that, but it just as if on cue, the theme song from the 1966 Batman series hit. And I was just awestruck. And then later on, the 66 Spider-Man series came on. So I was, you know, for a comic fanboy like me, this was just heaven. And a latchkey kid. You know, I was a son of baby boomers. And the TV set, when I wasn't playing sports, was essentially our babysitter. And the hits kept on coming at the weekend when International Championship Wrestling, ICW, invaded my family's living room, nearly doubling my TV wrestling intake. ICW managed to squeeze more sheer violence in an hour, most of it during their TV opening, than even Jarrett's show could produce in 90 minutes. And if you haven't seen this, the intro for the show featured quick cuts of just the craziest wrestling action you've ever seen. Fireballs, stiff chair shots, most of which delivered by Ronnie Garvin to chop Andre the Giant down to size. Wicked pile drivers. And frankly, scenes of outright midget abuse all set to chase the theme from Oliver Stone's classic 78 movie Midnight Express. And I have to think that this memorable montage of ICW mayhem likely inspired a young photographer in Louisville when he eventually broke into managing. And at the heart, right in the middle of all this fantastic mayhem, was our guest today. He is the leader of the Slapowitz Syndicate. I'm talking about the manager of the Devil's Duo, the ICW United States Tag Team Champions, Izzy Slapowitz. Izzy, welcome to Kentucky Fried Wrestling.
Well, believe you me, it's a pleasure to be here, Scott. A big pleasure to be here, believe you me.
And we were chatting a little bit before we came on, and it's so crazy to me to think that I'm talking with you today. You know, I first saw you guys when I was 9 years old. It was my jaw like really just hit the floor because ICW was just packed with these fantastic characters, fast-moving television, great storylines, and guys who could really work their ass off. Seemed like a fun place to be for the most part. Now, I know there are probably some inherent struggles being a so-called outlaw promotion or an independent. How did you wind up with this sort of, on the island of misfit toys, doing a wrestling promotion?
Well, it's very interesting. I had been in the wrestling business for quite a while before going to ICW, and my home base at the time was in Tennessee, and I had spent a good deal of time in Mississippi and then Oklahoma, and in the tri-state wrestling. And I got a call when I was in Oklahoma from a good friend of mine, a man I managed in Mississippi, Yasu Fuji, part of the Japanese Wrecking Crew. And Yasu said to me, Izzy, he said, I'm in Knoxville, and I'm working for All-Star Championship Wrestling. There was no ICW at the time. It was two separate groups. Well, there was an ICW, and then there was an All-Star Championship Wrestling, and they merged to ICW. But I was ready to go home. I was tired of being on the road, so I went back home to Knoxville. I called Ronnie Garvin, who was booking at the time, and I asked him if he would like me to come in, and he said yes. So I came into Knoxville, and I was working for All-Star Wrestling. And at the time, I was managing Bob Orton Jr., Barry Orton, his brother, and the Southeastern champion, Tony Peters, and Professor Boris Maximilianovich Malenko. They were my Slapowitz Syndicate in Knoxville. And what happened was the two groups, International Championship Wrestling in Kentucky and ICW, and All-Star Championship Wrestling became friendly and started doing shows together. And eventually, All-Star Wrestling, we started doing our TV with ICW. So basically, we were still two separate groups, but we were doing one television. Half of the show would feature ICW guys, half of the show would feature All-Star guys. The fans didn't know this. We knew this. They thought it was all one promotion. And when Randy Savage would come into the Knoxville area, I would manage him, and I would manage Rip Rogers in the Knoxville area at the time. And this was the second time I managed Rip Rogers. I managed him in Mississippi as well, a couple of years before that.
Okay.
So this is what happened there. And then eventually, All-Star Championship Wrestling closed up in Knoxville and merged with ICW in Kentucky, and some of us went up to Kentucky, not everybody. Malenko decided not to go, Terry Gibbs decided not to go, Tony Peters decided not to go, and Barry Orton decided not to go, and Ron Wright decided not to go. But the rest of us went up to Kentucky, And that's how I got involved mainly with the with International Championship Wrestling, ICW.
Okay. Now, in All-Star Championship Wrestling, was that the offshoot from sort of like the upright, like Ronnie Garvin, I believe Bob Roop, Bob Orton Jr. and Malenko? They were part of the traditional Southeastern territory, I guess under the banner of the National Wrestling Alliance. And I believe was there something, there was a power play there, right? Some kind of power struggle that led to them breaking out and starting All-Star Championship Wrestling and running opposition?
Yes, there was. There was some pay disputes, which I wasn't involved in the Southeastern at the time. I was in Oklahoma working for the NWA promotion there. So, you know, I can't really speak to that, except that my good friends, Ronnie Garvin, Bob Orton, Bob Roop, they were not happy with the way the pay was going there. So they got together, Roop Orton, Malenko, and Ron Wright. And they split off from Southeastern Championship Wrestling and went opposition to Ron Fuller at the time.
Right.
And when I came in, it was interesting because my good friend, the great Mephisto, Frankie Kane, when I came in, he had booked me into Mississippi and into Oklahoma, and then he left Oklahoma and went to Tennessee to work for Ron Fuller. So when I went to Tennessee to work for All-Star, my good friend Frankie Kane was booking for Fuller. Now, we lived in the same complex. We were, you know, we remained friendly during the whole thing because this was not between the boys. This was between promotions. It was a promotional war. But that is what happens in offshoots, yeah.
And I know you can't confirm this, and I certainly don't want to deal in rumor and innuendo, but it's my understanding that there was maybe a couple of robberies at the box office or allegedly or something like that, where the boys felt like maybe some of the like booking practice or bookkeeping practices maybe made famous by the Sheik Ed Farhat, where money was sort of disappearing from the house.
This was common in promotions back then. There were some promoters that were very, very good and honest with the boys, and there were some promoters that weren't. Now, I cannot speak again. You know, I can say that Ron Fuller had a very good reputation. People liked working for him, you know. For a small territory, it was also one of the most popular territories among the boys, because boys like going to work for Southeastern, and I think for the most part, they thought he paid well, and he ran a good promotion. But something happened there where all of a sudden the boys felt, and I'm not even sure if they thought it was Fuller that was doing it, okay? But there was money going missing, they felt. And I think when they approached the promotion, they didn't feel like their concerns were adequately addressed. And this is why they split. But again, I wasn't there at the time of the split. I wasn't involved with it, so I won't speak one way or the other towards it.
Now, and you mentioned, I believe, living in Tennessee. But originally, you were from Brooklyn, right?
That's right.
Okay. Born
and raised in Brooklyn, New York.
Never would have guessed with the accent. and grew up a fan of the heels. I believe you had a Fred Blesse unofficial fan club. Is that right?
That's right. A friend of mine, Big Bob, and myself, we were the first members of Blassie's Army, believe it or not, and then Blassie actually saw us with T-shirts at one of the shows and started talking about Blassie's Army on television. But I grew up in Brooklyn. I was a fan of the heels. My all-time favorite still. I look to him. I think he's one of the greatest that ever walked into the squared circle was Nature Boy Buddy Rogers.
Right. Favorite wrestler of Andy Kaufman, who would eventually make headlines. What do you think? Those guys. You look at them, and they just had it. You know, they had this charisma that almost just hung on them like a tailored suit. You know, Buddy Rogers, Fred Blassie, all these guys. What distinguished them from guys like today who, you know, you see guys, I don't want to sound like an old man, everything was better back in my day, but, you know, you see guys that are struggling. It's almost like they're trying to concentrate to remember their promo. And guys like Blassie and Lawler and Buddy Rogers, just so much of it was off the cuff. And you really got, and Jackie Fargo was one. He never, like Lawler told me, he never wrote down like a promo or thought about what he was going to say. He just went out there and just did it and it was in the moment. What are your thoughts on those guys as far as their personalities and their ability to talk people into the building?
Well, for one thing, all of them and all of those, and all of us, and even in my generation of wrestlers, we had a true love for the business. We had a true love for wrestling. It wasn't for the money, believe you me, because when most of us broke in, the money, you had to pay your dues. Okay? You know, the big money or good money didn't come till after we were wrestling for a couple of years. And I don't care who it was, that's the way it was. And we wrestled for many promotions, 7 days a week, sometimes between seven and nine shows a week, when you include TV. And we learned our craft from the guys before us. We all got trained, not like these guys do today, where they train them how to remember promos and how to read a script when they walk into the ring. You know, everything is scripted now. And so when that happens, there is no creativity. And somebody, when a team of writers writes a script for you to go out and do a promo, that's not creative. You don't learn anything from your craft with that. When a team of writers writes every move you make in the wrestling ring, and if for some reason you miss it, they just stop the tape and you do it over again, that's not learning a craft, not wrestling. So the guys today don't have that love, and they also don't have the work. And I'm not saying these guys don't work hard at what they do. They do. It's a tough sport today. With all these maneuvers they are expected to make and these dangerous high-risk maneuvers, but they're not on the road 7 days a week. They're not driving in cars 10 hours a day to go to a show and get in the ring for 20 minutes or an hour. They'll do that in an hour. They couldn't get into the ring for an hour. They wouldn't know what to do for an hour. Okay? But we did this daily. We didn't think about it. And the guys like Buddy Rogers and those guys didn't think about it. They just went out there and they did it. And nobody told anybody what to say. What happened was we would go and the booker would give you an idea. They would say, you're facing so-and-so. Next week, talk about the match. That's it. And you go and you have 1 minute to do it. And you go out there and you talk for 1 minute about the match or about the opponent. And if you weren't good at it, you wouldn't be on television the next time. So you had to get good at it. And that's the way it was. And it's the same thing with the matches. Nobody told us what to do in a match. You went out there into the ring with whoever your opponent was at the time, be it a tag team match or a singles match. You went in there. And you rent your 15 minutes, your 20 minutes, your half hour, an hour, 90 minutes even sometimes. Didn't matter. You did it without anybody telling you what to do. You just did it.
And don't you think that's how you found yourself you know, if you want to talk about, I mean, everyone talks about characters today. But that to me is sort of, you know, because it was still that way in Memphis when I, you know, Memphis was like the last of the dying breed. I got in the business in 91 as a referee, started managing when I was 94, and through 96. And it was the same way, you know, first of all, TV wasn't even written until about an hour before we went on the air. And it would be like maybe two or three things they would tell you and shove you out on live television through the curtain. But that's how you found it. It's how I found my voice. It's how I found my character. I didn't, you know, write anything down. And even in the ring, you talk about working 7 days a week. And not only that, but it's weekly towns. So you can't go back and do the same thing that you did last week. You were constantly having to evolve, change the match, change up the finishes. And it just, I mean, you can't help. I mean, if you applied yourself, you can't help but learn the ropes.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's what the guys today do not have. And we had that. Plus, the people that came before us, you had that, I'm sure, when you worked in Memphis. I had that in the territories I worked in. I was always privileged enough to be at a show. I mean, when I had 2 years' experience, I was still at a show on a show with somebody with 30 years' experience. When I had 20 years' experience, I still was on a show with somebody with 50 years' experience or 40 years' experience. So, and you never stop learning. I remember one time I was in I was working. It was after ICW. I was working for JCP. And I was actually working in Knoxville for the Southern Championship Wrestling, Blackjack Mulligan's and Ric Flair's promotion. But they were partners with Jim Crockett in the Carolinas. So we used to go all over the place. I mean, we worked the Carolinas, we worked both territories. So I was working in, I think it was Raleigh one time. And I was there with Jeff Sword and Doug Vines. But when we worked there, I didn't manage them on the Carolina end. They had their own managers there, and they didn't, Jeff and Doug didn't, they weren't even working as a tag team at that show. But I wrestled somewhere in the middle of the card. I wrestled this guy, Abe Jacobs. I don't know if you remember Abe Jacobs. But he was billed back at the time as the Israeli champion.
Yeah.
And I wrestled Abe Jacobs. You know, we had a very good match. We went 20 minutes, Broadway, you know, draw. And after the match, I came back to the dressing room, and I stayed. Yeah, you know, by the dressing room door, I would watch the other matches. And Ole Anderson came over to me. He was the booker. He said, "What are you still doing here? Why don't you go home?" I says, "What I'm still doing here is that I'm watching guys, other guys, how they work, so I maybe can learn something else, something more."
What did
he got pissed?
He got pissed. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, Ole got pissed at everything.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There was no right answer.
Yeah, Ole got pissed at everybody, you know, but that was Ole, you know. I saw him a couple of years ago. He said to me, "Izzy, did I like you? Did I?" I said to him, "No, you treated me like shit, but I don't care." "Who cares?" I said, "That was years ago."
See, if you had left when you were, you know, when you were supposed to leave, like, technically, he probably would have gotten on you. You know, "You need to be watching every single match. You need to learn."
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, there was no rule to leave. In most promotions, you didn't leave. You hung around just in case they needed you anyway for something else.
Right.
You never knew. You got there early, and you didn't leave till after the last fan left.
Yeah, that's the way it was in Memphis. And I don't want to dwell too much on this, but since we do talk a lot about Memphis wrestling, I know that before all that, you also had a very brief stint working for Nick Gulas in Tennessee. You had a match there. Maybe your first match in front of a big crowd. Maybe it didn't go as well as it should have, but still. But there was no excuse for what he did to you backstage. I understand he berated you in front of the boys. And Tom Renesto, who I believe was booking for him at the time, wanted you to stay, but you had your feel of Nick Gulas after one night. Is that true?
That's exactly right. I had been working very small, what we used to call back then, outlaw promotions, you know, in front of maybe 20, 30 people a night, you know, for a couple of years. That's how I paid my dues. And then I called Tom Renesto in Chattanooga, and I asked him, I said, Tom, I said, I told him who I was. I was going by a different name then, Pretty Smitty from New York City. And I said, I'm Pretty Smitty from New York. Yeah, oh, yeah, Pretty Smitty from New York City. I'm rough. I'm tough. I can't be beat. My opponents go running off into the street. Except I didn't say it like that. So Tom said, yeah, come on down. I'll take a look at you, the TV in Chattanooga. You know, they were doing the Chattanooga TV. They were doing the Nashville TV. So he asked me to come down to the Chattanooga TV. I came down there. They actually didn't have a spot for me on the TV show that was already booked out, but they had a house show that night. So they asked me to work the Chattanooga house show, Tom did. So I said, sure. So I hung around. I worked the Chattanooga house show. I worked with this guy, Butthead Jones. Very good hand.
Butthead Jones. Yeah, I believe he passed away a year or so.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. Well, I was nervous. I got there. This was a full house in Chattanooga. There must have been between 3,000 and 5,000 people there. I had never been in front of a crowd like this before. And believe you me when I tell you, my match sucked. At least I think it sucked. And I guess Nick thought it sucked too. But, you know, I got to tell you, I've seen much worse since then.
I'll bet.
But it wasn't good. I got back to the dressing room. I wasn't feeling good to begin with about it because I knew the match was a terrible match. And then Nick came back there. He started berating me and cursing me in front of all the boys and just saying stuff that shouldn't be said, not in front of anybody especially. And I didn't say anything to him. I went home, and I was waiting for my paycheck. I never got the paycheck. You know, it was a few days. It wasn't long. So I called Tom Renesto. I said, Tom, I said, when am I going to get paid for the show in Chattanooga? He said, well, I was hoping you'd come back down and work the territory. You know, I'll give you, you know, your paycheck when you come to TV next week. And I said to him, you know, I really appreciate it. Thank you, but I'm not working for that son of a bitch again. And Tom said, oh, he talks like that to everybody first time. And I said, that may be, but he's not going to have a second chance with me.
Wow.
And, you know, I passed it up. And 2 weeks later, I got a call from Frankie Kane in Mississippi to come to Mississippi.
And
that's when Izzy Slapovich was born.
And I think the only difference between you and a lot of people, they usually leave after they get that they leave after they get that first check from Nick Gulas, not before.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I the one thing, and sometimes it probably helped me, and sometimes it may have hurt me, but I always did. But you know, I was always a guy. If a booker asked me to do something, promoter asked me to do something, I did it. I didn't give a shit. I did it, okay? But if they didn't treat me with respect, I told them to, I don't want to use bad language, but I wouldn't put up with any bullshit.
You mentioned the birth of Izzy Slapovich. Can you explain exactly what the character was intended to be? Because I think some people have misinterpreted the thought behind it. Can you kind of explain how that happened?
Yes, it was interesting, really. I got down to Mississippi, and before I got down there, Frankie called me on the phone. He said to me, "I want you to buy an old Zoot Suit type outfit, a hat and a Zoot Suit type outfit, and then you come down to Mississippi. You're going to be a manager." I said, "Okay." So I couldn't find a Zoot Suit, but I found something similar. And I went down to Mississippi with Vic Connor. And do you remember Big Boy Williams?
Do.
Ralph Big Boy Williams?
Yeah.
He came down also. He wasn't Big Boy Williams at the time, but he came down to, we always called him Big Boy though. And we went down to Mississippi, and they used to do TV in Mississippi in Greenwood. So we got down there on Friday afternoon. Friday night, we did TV. So I went to the TV. It wasn't a studio. It was a sportatorium. It was a nice building. Was what they did was they used to film a house show there. And that would be our TV. It was an hour and a half television show, and the house show ran about 2 hours. There was a dark match. So I got to the TV, and Frankie Kane came. I met Frankie Kane, and I told him, I said, "Hello." I said, "I'm, you know, please, Smitty." He looked at me. He said, "Not anymore, you're not. You're Izzy Slapowitz now, kid." And I said, "Who?"
where did the name come from?
Well, there was an old time movie actor named Izzy Slapowitz, who I thought Frankie named me after. But a couple of years ago, I was talking to Frankie, and he told me that actually he had a friend when he was growing up named Izzy Slapowitz. Not really a friend. He was an older guy. Had a store in the neighborhood he was in or something, and the guy's name was Izzy Slapowitz, and that's where he got the name from. But so he said to me, "Now, you're Izzy Slapowitz." I had to write it down because I could never remember it. And he said to me, "You're the owner of a chain of pawn shops in New York City." Pawn being P-A-W-N. Okay. And you're here because you want to expand your pawn shop empire and now get into the wrestling business. You want to take all the money you made in pawn shops and start making money with wrestlers. And you're going to buy more pawn shops with the money you make. I said, "Okay." So this was maybe, you know, the show started taping maybe 7:30, and we're talking at 6 o'clock. And mind you, I had never done a television interview before in my life. He said to me, "And the show starts in an hour, and you're going to be interviewed by so-and-so in front of the ring." He said, "So think about what you're going to say and go out there and say it." So I went out there and I did the interview, and actually it went pretty good, I thought, and so did everybody else. Frankie was really pleased, and the boys there, they were pleased. And in fact, Rip Rogers, he had me manage him. He may have been there in the interview when I did that with me on that interview, or, you know, standing with me, or he may have joined me afterwards. I don't remember. But anyway, all was good. But then the next day I got a phone call from Frankie. He says to me, "Izzy, you're not going to believe this." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, when you said, well, the show showed on Saturday. So it was Saturday afternoon when I got the phone call." He says, when you said pawn shops, it sounded like pawn shops.
Porn.
P-A-W-N. P-O-R-N. And the TV people went crazy.
Oh, no.
And so we can't say that anymore. That's a no-no on TV here in Mississippi.
Yeah, the Bible Belt you're talking about. Yeah, you're talking about porn shops.
All right, so I guess we no more talking. So he didn't talk about the porn shops after that.
Oh, that would have been.
What happened was.
That would have been great if they give me like a subtitle gimmick.
Yeah. But everything else, and he told me, you know, he said to me, "Speak with an accent. You know, like a Lower East Side accent," which is what I did. and a Lower East Side, you know, Jewish accent, which is what I did. And I didn't have long hair at the time. It wasn't long. It wasn't short. You know, it was just I had a beard, but it wasn't big. And the character just evolved from there. I decided I didn't get my hair cut for a few weeks. And then one day I said to Frankie, I said, hey, I'm going to get a haircut. He said, no, you're not, Izzy. As long as you're working for me, you're not going to have a haircut. I said, okay. And slowly the character evolved. And as I became more comfortable with him, the one great thing about Frankie was that he let you just go with the flow. If you did something wrong, he told you. But other than that, he let you go do your thing. So I was able to develop the character. And he evolved over time. And from territory to territory, he changed. When I moved from Mississippi to Oklahoma, which is also with Frankie, we got to Oklahoma. And Leroy McGurk, who was a wonderful guy, a nice, good promoter, he told us that we couldn't use the name Izzy Slapowitz because Oklahoma's big Jewish community might become insulted. I said, how can they be insulted? I'm Jewish. He said, well, you know, people are funny. So I became a Russian in Oklahoma, Ilya Zimovich. But I used the same gimmick, except that I had a Russian name. And some people still called me Izzy because for some reason they knew me from from the Mississippi territory. So I know all the boys called me Izzy, but on TV I was Ilya. And then from there I went to Knoxville to All-Star.
And I believe you debuted for ICW shortly after they came on the air in Memphis, January 1980. Does that sound right?
I was working for them actually before that.
Okay.
You know, I don't even remember. Well, yeah, it may have been early 1980, either late 79 or 80 when I was with All-Star. And then I'm not sure when the first show was on in Memphis because we used to bicycle the tapes. So we might do a tape, you know, the show in Kentucky one week, and it may end up in Memphis 3 weeks later.
And do you remember what was the thought process about expanding into the Memphis territory? And Jerry Jarrett had the established territory there. He had, you know, he had also had his feel with Nick Gulas, came out on the Bandit end of a business deal there. Jerry Jarrett was our first guest and very gracious guy, gentleman, and just a guy who gave me so many happy memories of my childhood. But I was a huge, I was a huge fan of ICW, and I was thrilled that you guys were on the air there. And I don't think immediately I realized that you guys were promoting shows at the Cook Convention Center in Memphis, because I guess Jared had an exclusive clause with the Coliseum, and you guys were doing shows.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what was the thought process there, and what were the crowds like at the Cook Convention Center in Memphis?
Interesting you ask that. I think the thought process was Angelo Poffo. He wanted to expand. The territory was huge. This was maybe mile-wise the largest territory in the country, area-wise. We worked everywhere from Lexington, which is where we were based, Lexington, Kentucky. We went into West Virginia. We went into Virginia. We went into North Carolina. We went into Tennessee, you know, into Knoxville, Johnson City area, Knoxville and the Johnson City area. We were in Illinois. We were in Missouri. We used to run shows in Cape Girardeau. We were in Western Kentucky, in Paducah. So it was the territory was immense. We were in. I think I covered all the states. It was a huge territory, huge. And I think he was just, you know, this thing was, it's another big city that we're going that far anyway, even further. Might as well go into Memphis. We can draw some crowds. That, and I think he wanted to scritch Jarrett a little bit. because he felt that Jarrett was giving us a hard time in Lexington, keeping us out of Rupp Arena until we finally got in. So he wanted to give it back to Jarrett.
And who was there? Who was there first in Lexington? Because I know Jarrett went a little, you know, Louisville was established, and I'm not sure exactly when he started making inroads into Louisville. Was the ICW there first, or had Jarrett already started promoting shows at Rupp Arena?
I really don't know, but okay. My guess is Jarrett was already in Rupp Arena
okay.
by the time.
I know that Lawler won the, you know, Jarrett created it. You know, Jarrett sort of broke away from the NWA around that time and was still a member, but he started bringing in Bockwinkle as the AWA world champion and then created his own CWA world title that he put on Lawler. And he actually did that in Lexington at Rupp Arena. And I think they drew about 5,000 fans there that night. And I know at one point, and I think this may come later, but I was talking with Lance Russell, who I just thought the world of, and he was telling me that they had a big show in Lexington and it was one of the few nights that Dave Brown made a road trip, and they brought their wives and they hired a driver and they took a limo to Lexington. And he said they pull into the gates, and I guess Lance had a hand in getting on a television station in Lexington and that had dropped ICW. And he said they pull in and Savage starts scaling the cage, you know, the parking lot fence, and screaming, "Russell, I'm going to get you."
Yeah.
And
those were crazy times. In fact, they wanted us all to go down to that show. And I wouldn't go. I don't think Doug and Jeff went. A bunch of guys wouldn't go. Some of the guys did go. There was a lot of shit going on there with Randy threatening some of the Jarrett's boys, and there was an altercation with Bill Bundy with a gun, and it was just a mess. It really was. It wasn't, you know, it's funny in retrospect, but it really wasn't funny at all. It was it was not good stuff, because the boys only wanted to work. We all, you know. We weren't interested in that stuff, and it really got out of hand. But to get back to Memphis, so Angelo said, "Well, we're going to go into the Cook County." It's Cook County, right?
The Cook Convention Center.
Yeah. Yes, the Cook Convention Center. So we're going to go into the Cook Convention Center, and almost all of us said, "Angelo, let's wait. It's too soon." We had only been on Memphis TV for a few weeks. Now, back then in the day, the rule of thumb was you let your TV run 12, 13 weeks before you did a house show in a major city. You know, you could do spot shows. But if you just got TV in a major city, you let that city run a good 12, 13 weeks before you ever went in there. You need to get the boys over, you know. And especially in the case of Memphis, where Jarrett's group was over big time.
Oh, huge.
Lawler was over. Dundee was over. Jarrett, these guys were over. And I had some good friends in that promotion, you know, Troy Graham and Donnie Bass. And, I mean, that was a excellent promotion. And we begged Angelo, "Wait, it's not time to go to Memphis yet. We're going to Memphis." "Okay." So we went to Memphis. God knows how much money he spent on that building. And maybe 200 people showed up. Possibly less. Needless to say, Angelo wasn't very happy. You know, but
did the crowds improve over time? Because it was a tremendous television product. But like you said, I mean, the Memphis Wrestling Show, it was such a it was beyond a popular wrestling show. It was a cultural phenomenon. I try to explain it to people, and I know that wrestling was hot in every territory, but it just, you know, I think part of it too that made it special was the fact that Memphis didn't have a professional sports team. So it made the local stars that much bigger. And the fact that Lawler, the top single star, was actually from the city of Memphis, went to Treadwell High School, briefly attended Memphis State University. He was essentially the home team.
No, ICW never did well in Memphis. Not on house shows. We did well in other towns, but not in house shows. In Lexington, when we finally got into Rupp Arena, we used half the arena. Okay, they curtained off half, and we used the other half.
Yeah, I think that's what Jarrett's crew did as well.
Yeah. We had 10,000 people there. Rupp Arena held 20,000 people. We filled up a complete half.
Wow. Yeah, but that was better than Jarrett was doing.
Yeah, well, but we were over in Lexington. He was over in Memphis. You know, that's the way it is. People, local people like their local shows.
Right.
Back then, you know, I remember in Knoxville when Jim Barnett, who was running Atlanta and Georgia Championship Wrestling was so hot at the time, and they would put 16,000-17,000 people in the Omni every Friday night. When they came to Knoxville, they couldn't put 3,000 people in the Coliseum. That's what happens.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this before we got on the air. The promos. Now, to a 9-year-old like myself, I didn't quite get it. And actually, and to this day, I in a way, I still don't. So many of the ICW promos, I vividly remember Memphis was trying to push. We mentioned Torrey Graham, who I ended up managing in 94. They were strongly trying to insinuate that it was Dusty Rhodes under a hood has the Dream Machine, the stand back powder commercials, the pain reliever commercials were airing in Memphis with Dusty, and he, you know, Torrey would come out shucking and jiving and mention the stand back. Lawler, you gonna need a lot of stand back powder, baby, and all this kind of stuff. And the whole thing with the Dream Machine and the American Dream, and the, you know, and he had Dusty's rap. You know, he could actually almost
yes
do,
he did
he could actually do Dusty better than Dusty.
yes, he actually could, because that was Troy.
Yeah.
Troy spoke like that.
Yeah. Oh, just unbelievable. Just a tremendous promo guy. If anybody listen to this, if you haven't heard Troy Graham, the late great Dream Machine, do yourself a favor and look him up on YouTube.
But I
remember though, Bob Orton Jr. And Savage were out cutting promos and they revealed his identity on the air, you know, and I think Savage exposed Tojo Yamamoto as being Harold Watanabe from Hawaii. He's not even a Jap. He's from Hawaii. And all this kind of stuff. And that made you uncomfortable, didn't it?
Yes, it does. It did then. I thought it was not necessary. It was bad for the business and just wasn't necessary. We were good enough. You know, that's something a second-rate promotion do because they didn't have... If you don't have the talent. We had the talent. I would take the guys that were working in ICW at the time and put them up against any promotion in the country, and no promotion could even come close to the talent that we had. Not even close. You had Randy Savage. You had Bob Roop. You had Bob Orton Jr. You had Malenko for a while. You had the Devil's Duo. You had George Weingroff. You had Lanny. You had the great Tio came in for a while.
Pez?
Yes, you had Pez Watley, one of the best ever, okay? And you take that crew and the angles that we did. Nobody was doing angles like we did. Nobody even came close. I remember... I stuck a hypodermic needle into Roddy Garvin's arm.
I remember.
And he started foaming at the mouth. Nobody would ever dream of doing stuff like that. going off the top rope with a knee to a midget.
I think that was in the intro at some point.
Yeah. We did stuff that nobody even dreamed of doing. You know, I did a promo one time when the Devil's Duo won the U.S. Tag Team Championship. I don't know if you remember this. And I went out there and I had a picture. My sister-in-law painted a picture. She was able to paint. And she had painted, I asked her to do this, she painted a picture of the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Wow.
Now, if you remember, at that time, was in the,
yes.
was in the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis.
Yes.
Okay? And I put that picture under my robe. And when the Devil's Duo, we went out there and we did, it was the first interview we did after they won the title there in Henry Clay High School. And we went out there and I said, I've been getting letters of congratulations from all over the world. I said, but the one that is most dear to my heart is the one I got from my cousin. Maybe you know my cousin. And I pulled out the picture and I showed the picture of the Ayatollah. Mm. And I read the letter saying, congratulations. I hope that you will soon come and defend your title where it belongs.
Yeah. Oh,
in my country.
The U.S. Yeah. belts.
Yes, the U.S. belts. And I'm holding the picture of the Ayatollah up there. It was in front of a live TV audience, and the people went crazy. They started booing. They started throwing stuff. So I looked at the camera, and I said, oh, yeah? Well, how many hostages do you have? And we walked off the camera.
Oh my God!
Let me tell you something. Yeah, I got back. We got to the back, and Angelo says to me, "What are you crazy? How can you say something like that?" He said, "Do you understand what's happening now?" He said, "What's happening?" Well, what's happening was, it didn't take long that people started driving up to the TV studio, and they were surrounding the TV studio. There was a huge crowd out there. They had to call the police to escort us out of the studio.
Were you wearing a bulletproof vest or anything at this point?
No. But, you know, I believe me, in some of those towns, I had gunpoint that pulled on me 101.
You have to understand too. You're in the Bible Belt, and you're already managing a tag team called the Devil's Duo.
Yeah, so we used to do that prayer in the ring there. So, on top of that,
that's not enough heat for you. You have to take it one step. And back then, see, that's one thing too that I think that's sort of lost on people. You couldn't help but be aware when you were a kid. I think you were more socially aware of the issues that were unfolding because, again, there were only three or four channels. Walter Cronkite would come on, and everyone would sit around and watch the news. So you were aware of what was going on. Even as a kid, I knew that the hostage situation was very serious and a huge deal.
Yeah.
And the Ayatollah was such a polarizing figure. And it's crazy. That borders on maybe the wrong kind of heat.
Well, that was unbelievable. And no other promotion would do stuff like that. You know, they wouldn't think of it. And even if they did it, they wouldn't air it on TV. You know, if I had pulled that on some other promotion, they wouldn't have aired it on TV. We went with it.
Yeah.
And Angelo was pissed because he wasn't – you think Nick was cheap. Angelo was pretty frugal with the dollar there. He hated that he had to pay for security for a long time after that, because when we went, it was dangerous after that, with fans coming after us.
I'll bet. He didn't always pay for security, though, did he?
It was on a very, very rare occasion that Angelo paid for security. And that came back to bite us in the ass more than once. He didn't pay for it, but the rest of us, he wouldn't pay for the security, so the rest of us paid for it. We were in a town one time in Illinois. I think it was Illinois. It may have been Missouri. I don't remember. But I had handed I think it was either Orton or the duo with Chain. I think it was the duo with Chain in a tag match with Lanny, against Lanny and George. And as soon as I handed them the chain, everybody in the armory, it was in the National Guard armory, attacked me. I had to curl up in a little ball on the floor while all these fans were coming over and trying to kick me and punch me. As it turned out, they were kicking themselves as much as they were kicking me. And then finally, Lanny and George came out into the crowd and said, pushed them away, and they said, we'll take care of them, we'll take care of them. And they got me back to the dressing room, and my knee was swollen like a football. In fact, that was the beginning of the end for me in ICW, because I called Angelo a cheap son of a bitch for not having security. And he didn't like that. And it went downhill from there. It was a few weeks later that I left.
He was working as the miser.
He was working as the miser. He was the miser.
But don't call me cheap.
And I got to tell you, I liked him. Hmm. I did. I liked him. Except for the money part.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. No, I get it. It seemed like to me, like the people ask me like, did ICW, did they just hotshot a bunch of stuff? And I was like, no, that's shortchanging those guys. They did a lot of crazy stuff, but the storytelling was riveting. It was one of the most episodic television programs. I think Jarrett's program was very good. Because they ran, they ran Memphis every week. They ran a lot of the same towns every week. So it not only was the Saturday morning show very episodic, but so was the booking, I think, around the territory. But ICW was right there. It was almost like Memphis, but turned up a notch. If Memphis went to 10, maybe ICW went to 11 or 12.
How ICW's booking went. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
A couple of days of the week, in a smoke-filled room in one of the boys' apartments, there would be the main booking team, which was Savage and Orton and Garvin, and a bunch of the other boys. I would be there sometimes, and George and Rip, and we'd be sitting there, and we'd sit there for hours and just talk about crazy shit that we could do that would make sense for a good story, for a good angle. And some of the stuff we used and some of the stuff we didn't, but that's how it, and then once somebody come up with something, then that everybody, that Andy liked or that Garvin liked or Orton liked, they would, run with it, and then start expanding on it. And then these things took lives of their own. And we just went, sometimes it would start one way and then we'd get there on TV. And because our promos and interviews weren't scripted, okay, things would be said on TV that would take the angle in a whole different direction. Or we would do stuff on TV that would take the angle in a whole different direction. And we'd go with it from there. And then something else would happen and it would change and it would go from there. But there was a lot of thought process and work went into it.
I would hate to see the ideas that got rejected. because just so much crazy stuff. I remember the mop head. I remember the loser would have to wear.
That was all Ronnie. Yeah.
Okay. I remember the loser would have to wear a t-shirt that said sissy.
Yep.
I remember obviously a guy would lose a match, be painted yellow.
Yep.
Your requisite head shavings. I believe didn't Pez get kidnapped and Garvin put made him Miss Macho or Miss ICW and he looked like Brenda Britton, but
he did that. I mean, there was so much stuff going on, And a lot of it was just, you know, funny shit. We'd say, oh, this would be right. Let's do that. But sometimes we talk about something or we do something that nobody was expecting. Like a couple of guys would get together and say, let's do this on TV. They wouldn't tell anybody else. They wouldn't tell Angelo. They wouldn't tell Randy. We'd just get on TV and do it. And once it's done on TV, you got to go with it. You can't walk it back.
I've told the story a couple of times, but you'll appreciate this. And I don't know if it was because maybe on a subconscious level, I was channeling ICW. But when I turned heel, basically Eddie Gilbert did that as a favor to me. I had some friends from college in attendance, and I said, you know, I knew that they were trying to create like a big schmoz there, and they're looking for a way to have a no decision. And I said, what if you go to throw the fire at Lawler and he ducks and it hits me and it just, you know, the whole thing just breaks into a brawl. And he goes, let me think about it. And so Lawler calls me in to give me the finish later on. He goes, Scott, we're going to turn you heel tonight. And I just looked over at Eddie and he's kind of, you know, rubbing his chin and smiling, you know, devilishly. And I got to TV Saturday and I'm thinking I'm the hot new heel manager. And they tell me, no, you're going to go out there and apologize. And I'm like, what? And I go, I just like, you know what? It's live TV. What can they do? And I went out there and I Lance goes, do you have anything to say for yourself? And I said, yeah, I've been refereeing around here for a long time now. Lawler's pushed me. He has shoved me. You know, I'm not like Jerry Calhoun, his old softball buddy. I stomped him like the cockroach that he is when I got the chance. And I was told in the back that Lawler was looking at the monitor and goes, what the hell is he doing?
And, they probably liked it.
They loved it because they were going to switch. Yeah. They were going to switch me back, and because I guess I was going to manage Eddie Gilbert for like a week, and because of my inexperience, I was going to screw up, and then they were going to switch me back, and then I'd come back as a referee. But I was like, nah, man, I don't want to do that. but again, what you're saying though is. It doesn't surprise me to hear that because I think the fans get a sense of something. I'm not going to use the word organic, but I'll just say that there's a hint of danger when the boys themselves don't know exactly what's going to happen. And
yeah.
And something takes a turn. That's what, you know, the format for Memphis was very, I mean, you know, there weren't a lot of sentences on that 90-minute format, even when I got into it. And so I can only imagine what it was with ICW where, you know, you might have an idea where things are going to go. And some of it, sometimes you're just working off a crowd, but so much improv is into it. And what you were saying, maybe a couple of guys had an idea that they wouldn't share with anybody else and it would like be a stroke of genius. And then there might be a storyline you think is going to go one way, but then the boys take it another.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's what professionals do. That's what differentiates a professional from some hack that's just reading a script.
I had a friend of mine who went with me to a NWA Legends fan fest, and he didn't, he was sort of a casual wrestling fan growing up, and he was in North Carolina for some kind of other business and met me there. And he goes, I don't get it. I don't understand. Like, why are so many people here for these older wrestlers? And why are they so passionate about it? And I said, well, think if you grew up, and I was a huge NFL fan growing up. And even though the game has changed, largely, I think, to protect some of the players, it's essentially the same thing. But wrestling is, as we knew it and loved it, is dead.
It's dead. It doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I tried to bring it back, and hopefully, maybe that'll work out. But
tell me,
for the most part, it's dead. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, Izzy, because I didn't know about this until you told me. Tell me about the most recent venture you were involved in.
Well, I was involved in a promotion called International All-Star Championship Wrestling, IACW. And we had a TV show, an hour TV show, weekly show. It ran in Chattanooga, in the Chattanooga area, and also that on a regular broadcast station. And it also ran on video on demand on in the Knoxville area on both Comcast and Charter Cable. And we produced 21 hour-long shows. Ronnie Garvin did the color commentary along with Joe Cazana, who maybe some of the fans out there are familiar with. He wrestled for WCW and Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And they did the color commentary. Izzy Slapowitz managed the heels. We had some really, really good young talent mixed with some veterans like Ron Sexton and Tom Pittner and Deke Rivers. And we also had some really, really good young talent who some of these guys who were trained by guys like George South and by Ricky Morton. So these guys, not WWE type wrestlers. These guys were old school wrestlers. And we did 21 hour long shows. They're excellent. They can still be, if any of your listeners want to watch them, they're all available on YouTube, every one of those shows, under IACW Pro Wrestling or IACW Championship Wrestling. And they're also on Facebook, on the International All-Star Championship Wrestling Facebook page. All of the episodes are on there as well. But there are 21 episodes, all completely old school, the same kind of angles and things that that you saw on ICW and on Memphis Wrestling, the same wrestling, not a bunch of people flying around in the ring. We didn't allow it. Things that you're familiar with, high spots were limited to one or two a match. The boys wrestled. And most of the finishes were submission holds or pins and disqualifications, of course, too. But really, really some good stuff, some T-shirt stuff. We have some excellent lady wrestlers on there, Misty James, and some other good women wrestlers, and just a good show. And like I say, it ran for 21 weeks, and now we're trying to market it to a major network or a major streamer so we can get it out there and resume production. And hopefully we will.
Now, does anybody come off the top of a cage with a big elbow onto a midget? Or
no, there are no cages. We were on a limited budget. But there was some nasty stuff going on.
I'm referring to the Randy Savage angle. Was it Wee Willie?
Yes, it was Wee Willie. I'll tell you the story behind that. He had to go in for surgery. He was a dwarf. And unfortunately, people with that condition, they need to go in for surgery, sometimes very often. It's very expensive surgery. And of course, back in the day, if wrestlers had health insurance, it was because their wives had it. But, promoters didn't offer health insurance or anything like that. So in order to help him with his medical bills, and I know this sounds crazy, but we did the thing where Andy went off the top rope and with the elbow on him. And then they did a collection for him to help with his medical bills.
Wow. Yeah. And it looks absolutely brutal. I mean, a Savage elbow anyway was pretty brutal.
Oh, he was so good at what he did. He really was. Randy Savage could work. And he was very good with stuff. Nobody did that back then, off the top rope with the elbows and walking the top rope. He was one of the first to do that. And he was very good at it. And he was very good in the ring, basically 100%. And he was good with his interviews,
Yeah, I remember the freak out. Doing the thing, and all that kind of stuff. I think there's a clip of this in the much ballyhooed opening that I was referring to earlier. He's celebrating with confetti. He's kissing a snake. It's like this.
Yeah.
He was so larger than life. Stuff. I just,
yeah.
Oh, he was so and man, when he finally when ICW eventually went under and he debuted for Jarrett, I didn't get to go to the Coliseum too often. You know, I got to go about 5 times a year. So when I asked to go, I had to make sure that it counted. And yeah, when Randy debuted, I had to be there because it was like the dream match that I've been waiting for about 4 years.
Yeah, he was really good. And the thing a lot of people don't realize about Randy is who you saw on television was who you saw if you went to his house to hang out. There was no difference. Randy Savage was not a character, you know, that was invented for television. Randy Savage was Randy Savage no matter where he was or what he did.
And we talked a little bit about the fact that there wasn't much, you didn't get rich working in ICW for that reason. But, and because of the television product was so, it seemed like a real collaboration with everyone pitching in, coming up with ideas and, and sometimes even on the fly, it seems like it was a very close knit crew, probably a lot more so than Memphis, where the money was good because guys were constantly backstabbing one another for and protective of their spot. You hear a lot of stories, you know, about when Hanson Jimmy started getting hot in Memphis and, oh, turn him heel. The Freebirds start getting over. They switch him babyface. They got a little too over maybe in Lawler's eyes. Switch him heel, but switch him back heel. The babyface turn didn't work. But in ICW, it seemed like it was maybe a closer-knit group of guys. Is that the case?
Yes, it was very close. And I got to tell you, in most territories I worked, it was close. There was always sometimes one or two guys that weren't as close as other guys. But in most territories I worked, the boys were close with each other. Because, you know, you get to know it, you know, you meet each other in different places. You know, you work with a guy in one place, then you're working with him somewhere else. So, yeah, but in ICW, it was especially close-knit. And, I mean, we were tight. And as a testament to that, I mean, I'm still close with Ronnie Garvin. I'm still close with George Weingroff. I'm still close with Jeff Sword. I mean, there are guys, you know, I see Rick... I see
Rip Rogers. You ever see him?
I saw Rip Rogers about a year ago, a year and a half ago. I'm sorry, I still talk to him on, you know, on the computer.
Yeah,
we are still close. It's a close knit group still to this day. Big Boy Williams and I have been friends for 40 years.
Well, you know, you mentioned Big Boy Williams earlier. What was the angle that you guys with something with like stuffed animals?
I'll tell you, that's funny. Yeah, we didn't know what to do with Big Boy. Okay, he was when he first came to All Star. He was in Mississippi. He was a referee, and in Oklahoma, he was a referee. But the guy could work. So he got to. When we got to Knoxville, Big Boy came back to Knoxville with me. He also lived there. He worked under a hood first as the Mighty Yankee. And one day I'm sitting there with Bob Roop, and everybody liked Big Boy. Not everybody in every promotion liked him, but everybody in All-Star loved him. So I said, Bob, why don't we do something with Big Boy? He says, what? I said, well, I had this idea. I said, put him in a pair of cut-off long johns with a pair of, you know, tights, you know, trunks over them. I said, my daughter has some stuffed animals. We can give them to him. We'll get him a little toy coal miner's hat, a little plastic coal miner's hat to put on his head. I said, and let's do this thing with him. He's simple, and he comes on there, and you know, you do an interview with him saying how his father was killed in the coal mines, and it's only him and his mommy, and all he has to remember his dad with is this coal miner's hat, is this little toy,
which a lot of people could probably identify with.
Yeah, and he had these little stuffed animals, and Roop loved it. So I said, let's call him. We'll call him Big Boy Williams. Everybody called him Big Boy anyway. So Roop said, good idea. Let's try it. So we did that. We got some bathtub toys. You know, little toy
like little ducky and
yeah, little ducky. Those were all my daughter's toys, and Big Boy loved it. And he went out there and he got over.
How Big Boy is. Did you bite the head off of his stuffed head, or am I just imagining that?
I don't remember if I did or somebody did, or if he did, but I think we did that.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Wow.
A lot of this stuff I don't remember exactly who, what, or when, but I know we did.
Well, and I'm sure it was all just a blur. Because you guys were doing just such insane stuff all the time. What do you I reached out to you recently. Some people may not know this, but I started putting ICW logo shirts on the official store of the KFR podcast at KentuckyFriedWrestling.BigCartel.com. And that was after talking to Joe Stassi, who runs the ICW group on Facebook. And I mentioned that to him that, we're trying to create T-shirts that fill a need. And if you watched ICW for your fan back in those days, you couldn't help but love it. And it's quickly becoming one of our fastest selling shirts. And that's what, started the dialogue with you and I, because we were going to do a deal where we give $2 to $3 from every shirt to an ICW wrestler who might need a helping hand. You and I have talked about that. Explain the bond, the passion that still exists with the fans today. Are you amazed by that?
Yeah, I'm blown away by it, because for many of us who worked at ICW at the time, we couldn't wait to get out. I'm being frank with you. We loved the boys. We loved each other, but it was the trips were very, very long. It was a tough territory to work. And as much fun as we had while we were working, because we did, we had a blast. We couldn't do it if we weren't having fun. When you're traveling 8-10 hours a day, 7 days a week, it wears you down. We weren't hopping in planes. We were riding in the back of ring trucks. We were hitting the road in cars, and it wore you down. But we became very, very close friends because of it. And but we all went on to different things afterwards. And I even made a comment to a couple of boys. I cannot believe it may be more popular now than it was then. It's become like a cult. I hate to use the word cult, but it's taken on a life of its own now, so many years later. And I think people appreciate it more now than they did then. Those of you who were fortunate enough to see it, and I feel fortunate enough to have been a part of it, I really do. And it wasn't available all over the country. We were available in many states, but in some places it was on, off channels, not major channels. And it wasn't a major promotion like the WWF was, or like Memphis was. It just wasn't anywhere like that. So when I see how popular it is now, it blows me away.
Yeah, and it's really easy to watch an episode, to watch it back. At the time I wasn't necessarily thinking of it. I just knew that I loved the television show, and it was great. Not only great story, I didn't even know what storytelling was. You know what I mean? As a 9 or 10 year old, I just knew that I had to watch it every single week, because I was hooked on it. And it took nothing away from my love of Memphis wrestling.
It shouldn't. There were two different things.
Yeah. Yeah, but to me, though, I honestly, when people ask me about it, I think this is probably the biggest compliment I can give ICW, because Memphis was very unique and innovative. That said, it was, you know, there are elements that you would see on Memphis TV in Florida, in Mid-South, in Georgia. ICW, there was really nothing like it.
No, there really wasn't. And, you know, and that's saying something, because Tennessee wrestling as a whole, when I say that, Memphis TV, Nashville TV, Knoxville TV, there was some crazy shit going on all those TVs that nobody in the rest of the country saw. Nobody. Okay? I know, I remember you guys did an angle of Memphis with Donnie Bass with the country and western singing. Do you remember that?
Yeah, the singing cowboy.
The singing cowboy. That is one of the most hilarious angles I ever saw. And it was great.
With Bobby,
the whole thing was so good.
Bobby Bear playing in the background. Bobby Bear, the country musician, was a neighbor of Jerry Jarrett's, and I think he got the...
Really?
Yeah.
But, you know, nobody did that stuff. Nobody. You know. Or in Knoxville, when Ronnie Garvin threw the Southeastern Belt off the Gay Street Bridge. You know, and the cameras were filming. Nobody did that stuff.
Well, and then, you know, years later, in the Attitude Era... Everyone still talks about the big angle with The Rock and Steve Austin, where Austin throws the Intercontinental Belt into the river.
Ronnie did it first.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. What kind of booker was? I mean, obviously, I know from the television, but he didn't. I don't think he had a hand in the creative process at all when he went to work for Crockett. What kind of booker was Ronnie? Really quickly, as if it weren't evident in the TV.
Ronnie is a genius when it comes to that. Ronnie knew all his stuff at Southeastern. He had a hand in. And a lot of people don't realize it. When Ronnie was in Southeastern Championship Wrestling working for Fuller, Ronnie Garvin and Archie, the Mongolian Stomper, okay?
I'm a huge Stomper fan.
Okay. They were, you know, I managed the Stomper at one time. Those were probably the two biggest stars ever to work in that. That's how to work in that territory as far as popularity goes. Ronnie Garvin was as popular in the Southeastern area as Bruno Sammartino was in the WWWF.
And for our fans, I guess he was like Knoxville's Jerry Lawler.
That's right. He was like Knoxville's Jerry Lawler. And Ronnie, okay, had a hand in the booking of all those matches that he was in. And when I we were doing the taping at, you know, for my IACW shows, I ran a lot of stuff by Ronnie. I did the booking for the show, but I did a lot of stuff by Ronnie. You know, and always took advice, still take advice from Ronnie. Ronnie's booking is genius when he wants to. In some of these territories, they didn't want to listen to him, and you know what? Or he felt like, you know, I want to stay out of it. Like when he worked for JCP, you know, he wasn't involved in that at all.
Which is a shame.
In fact, Dusty didn't want him to get the title. When they made Ronnie world champion, Dusty was the booker. They went around Dusty's back to promote him. And I think it was not George Scott, his brother. No, it was George.
Sandy Scott, I guess was.
No, it wasn't Sandy. It was George.
Okay.
It was George and Crockett. Okay. They wanted Ronnie as champion. And then, you know. Dusty put the screws to it after once he got the belt.
Was Dusty pushing for Barry Windham to get it? Or do you know?
Dusty was pushing for Dusty to get it.
Well, yeah.
There's no gray area.
Right. That is a shame that I like a lot of the stuff that Dusty did, but I do think that obviously by the end of 87, he was done. And spent, and he was recycling ideas. It would have been great if they had transitioned into Ronnie. That would have been really interesting to because Dusty had kind of set the table, and it would have been really great for Ronnie to run with it at that point. But
well, Ronnie had Ronnie had that title for a while, but Dusty made sure he didn't keep it long.
Well, the whole thing, yeah, it was awful the way they did it. It was almost like it was doomed to, because he went at Detroit, and then I think they did a deal where he didn't. I guess he got an extension on the 30-day where he wouldn't have to defend it every 30 days, which a babyface does not do. So by the time they get to Chicago, which was a horseman town anyway, Ronnie's booed out of the building and people are rooting for Flair, who's doing all his typical heel spots to no avail. But yeah, it's a shame. I think they almost waited too long because the Garvin Flair stuff was so physical. And and like Dusty, I think the fans got into it because he was the antithesis of Flair, you know, the hard nosed guy, you know, straight talker, you know, a guy who the fans mm-hmm. believed in, but could keep up with Flair in that physical style. And it had a promo style that wasn't polished, but that was the point.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. No, and those guys had, Ronnie and Flair had some great matches.
Oh, man, tremendous. Tremendous.
Had some great matches. Ronnie is one of the best ever in the business. That's my opinion.
I joke. I think if Johnny Valentine were watching some of those Flair Garvin matches, he probably would have winced and looked away.
Yeah,
that's a compliment. Oh, well, Izzy, I feel like I've talked your head off here. I feel like we've, in a way...
Well, it's been my pleasure. It really has been.
You have no idea. So many of those characters, and I almost hate to use the word character, but they were larger-than-life personalities. And for a Memphis fan to be swayed by this new promotion coming in, and it was can't miss TV. I mean, from 10 a.m., you know, it's for a couple of years, my viewing habits was Memphis from 11 a.m. to 12:30. It changed 10 a.m. with it starting with ICW. And then in a way, it was almost like Memphis had to follow that.
Well, you know, I can't tell you how good it makes me feel to hear this from you and from other people who tell me how much they appreciated what we did, because, you know, it's hard to gauge while you're doing it. It's hard to gauge how much people are liking it. I mean, I knew that there were times when we were doing our jobs well, because one time in Kentucky, a deputy sheriff put a gun to my head. when stuff like that happens, you know, you're doing something right. But, you know, as far as the wrestling world goes, but you never really know how much the people are liking it or not, or appreciating it, until like now, years later, when I hear this from you, when I hear this from some other people, it does my heart good. Believe me, it really does.
Well,
makes it feel like it was well worth it.
Man, I hope so. I hope so. And I love the fact that we're all still talking about it so many years later. It's amazing. So I think that speaks to the legacy of ICW.
Yeah.
Well, hey, promise me you'll come back and talk to us some more down the road.
Anytime you want me, I'm here. You got my number. Just give me a holler. You got my Facebook stuff. So you give me a holler, and anytime you like, I'll be there.
All right, Izzy. Thank you. Everyone, that was...
Thank you, Scott.
Izzy Slapowitz, ICW legend. We'll be right back with more Kentucky Fried Wrestling right after this.
Freak out! No confetti! No nothing! For nobody! Situations develop, man! ICW World Champion Macho Man Randy Savage won the belt and defended it with honor! And then all of a sudden, some guy who calls himself the one-man gang rules a dynasty. I still have the attitude and the guts to and made me a super ball player and world champion professional wrestler. And they fired my manager, Steve Cooper. You put me against the wall, man. And another guy would sink to his knees and beg for your mercy, Garvin. But I'm gonna stand up tall, man. 6'2", 235. Because last night, stirred at a candle for about 2 hours and got my head together and realized I'm gonna have to make it without Cooper because you got him suspended. Roll a BTR. Show him why. Roll it. For no reason. The mass protege supposed to be my partner. Garvin paid him probably about $25. Put a mask on him and unveiled him as the referee. And got himself from being suspended. Trying to make me look stupid. Staring at that candle gave me new light. You ain't exposing nobody. All you did was kick a lion in the back. Turn my back to you. The name is Macho Man Randy Savage. When I get you down in the ring, I'm going to make you say it. I'm going to make you crawl to your knees and say, please, Macho Man, let me go. And then I'm not going to. I'm done. Take me off the air. Take me off the air.
And welcome back to KFR. I don't know about you, Brian, but it always makes me a little sad to hear morose Macho. No freak out. No confetti. Not going to do the thing. All because esteemed manager Steve Cooper has been unjustifiably suspended, thanks to Ronnie Garvin. Well, and all of you will sound just as crestfallen if you mess out on our Macho array of ICW logo t-shirts. Now, we created these 100% combed cotton t-shirts using a completely new vector art logo based on the ICW Classic logo. Frankly, it has never looked any better. And as Izzy and I discussed during the podcast, we have contacted a former champion in ICW, and he's had some medical problems over the last several years. And so we are going to donate $3 of every ICW shirt we sell directly to the wrestler. Not at liberty to name this man just yet, but believe me, I honestly think that all ICW fans will agree we've made the right choice. You can buy the bestseller ICW logo tee and vintage gold, red or white, at tinyurl.com/macho-shirt. But wait, there's more. We've also got ICW coffee mugs because the cream always rises to the top in the ICW. That's right, as the Macho Man would say. And dropping on Wednesday, April 18th, we will have ball caps with the ICW logo with a 3D puff print, which looks incredibly macho. And we also have ICW phone cases. Now, our profit margins on those items are pretty slim, but we are still going to donate a dollar from every one of those to the former ICW great we mentioned previously between now and April 30th. And also, Hanna-Barbarian artist Travis Heckel and I will match the profits for what we hope is one large donation at the end of the month. You can find the entire store at tinyurl.com/KFRstore. You can find me on Twitter at Trav Scott Bowden and on Facebook at facebook.com/Kentucky Fried Wrestling. Kentucky Fried Wrestling is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And before we go,
I just want to say that this episode is dedicated to the memory of Nick Nahad, a.k.a. Mr. Clyde, a.k.a. Mr. Ali Bin Khan, who passed away recently after a long bout with cancer. Nick was a good buddy of mine, along with Brian Lawler, Kevin Lawler, Tony Williams. You may know them as the New Kids. And a bunch of other guys, Jeremy Williams, Mr. Sunshine, and we all worked a bunch of outlaw shows together, much to the chagrin of Jerry Lawler. And eventually, Brian and Tony, along with Ali Bin Khan, found their way on Memphis TV, working as TV jobbers. Nick didn't go on to rise above anything past the preliminary bout status, but I think anyone who ever knew him would agree that he was a champion when it came to being a good friend and a human being. For Brian Last, this is Scott Ballen saying bye-bye, everybody.
The announcers on this program are selected and paid by parties other than this station, namely the promoters of Championship Wrestling.